Members, good morning. Good morning at this session, our public hearings jointly, the committees of the Standing Committee on Finance in the National Assembly and the Select Committee for Finance in the National Council of Provinces, dealing with the fiscal framework, revenue proposals, and the budget speech of the Minister of Finance, as referred to and published in ATC to the committees. Also, welcome to the organizations appearing before us today. We started yesterday, in total it will be 8 organizations making their submissions and putting themselves in the position of the Minister of Finance addressing this committee, telling us what is your ideas. Because collectively we must come up with a solution to take South Africa forward. If I look at the picture there, creating certainty, and one of the papers was said the minister provided a ray of hope and cracked a whip on tax evaders. So there's different angles to the budget. But when we go back to our constituencies, which is our work, is to go and inform our people where does the money come from and what is happening to the money. That's very important in terms of accountability and oversight. Also welcome to co-chair Honourable Thabo Mofemadi. The Select Committee and Standing Committee on Appropriations is running a briefing on the Division of Revenue concurrent with this meeting, so that's why some of our members are in the other meetings. We are better pleased this morning. Well, the meeting is inside and not outside, so they are welcome to enter. Yeah. The seats to sit on outside is nothing. They may come in. To PricewaterhouseCoopers, Professor Malachi, welcome. You're representing PricewaterhouseCoopers. We're going to give you 20 minutes to your presentation. After that, we will take the manufacturing shuttle and then go into the discussions. You're welcome.
So why did you just go out to call your colleague and the rest will let them again?
My colleagues are only obedient ones.
Thank you, Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm pretty certain I'll stick to 20 minutes. I'll do my best. The Chair mentioned, the PwC theme hopefully for this budget was creating certainty, and I think in current times that's probably one of the things that most people are looking for. And I think, unfortunately though, the only certainty that we have really confirmed and cemented this year is that the future is definitely uncertain. So our comments, my comments will be under those general headings. As always at the time, I know many of our members will know that for tax nerds such as myself, we wait for the devil in detail that comes out in a month or two when we actually see the specifics of the tax proposal in the amendment bill. So many of my comments will kind of be slightly reserved depending on how the details that we will see. But I'll run through some of the kind of overviewish views on the budget this year. Okay, so just from a general overview perspective, I must say I'm glad that the Chair said we pretend that we, the Minister of Finance, come in these discussions, because certainly, rather him than me. This is one of the things we need to recognize, that despite the fact that people like me sit here and criticize and make comments and present opposing views, we have to recognize that The minister is doing an amazing job. These are really, really hard times, and the fact that I'm going to say, for example, that I think prioritization is wrong. The wrong issues are being given priority. At the same time, I have to recognize that what really is the correct prioritization is not an easy question. So we do recognize that. As a general rule, we support the move to reduce the budget deficit by controlling expenditure better rather than by raising taxes. And overall, again, many of members would have seen us jumping up and down in previous years in, you know, a very aggressive opposition to certain proposals. And I think this year we're not there. We don't see any huge issues. And overall, the tax proposals we think are nice and tight and overall welcome. My criticism that's going to come later will be not so much about what the issues are that are being addressed, and I made this point several times. All of us in our professional lives and personal lives, and certainly the state as well, everyone knows that the to-do list is longer than your arm. You know, there's 30 items on the to-do list, and you know you can only get to 10. What is up to you is to decide what goes in the top 10, and that's probably where our disagreement is. So what's on the to-do list we don't agree about, but we think there are certain things that should be given with great priority. And I'll mention that as well. As far as the aspects that we welcome, as expected, the relief for individuals, we welcome that. The further increase in the deductions for retirement contributions, this, from my perspective, is you will see a positive and a negative. On the one hand, we welcome the proposal to increase the list. These are new proposals that were spoken about last year, but were never introduced in the year that's just passed, but they were always intended to come into effect only now. But the caps have been increased, and I'll talk on the next slide. I'm going to return to the point as well. The idea of encouraging investment and coming up with products to encourage that is something we support as well. And the youth employment incentive for employers, yes, the specifics, as I always say, the devil will be in the detail, but conceptually, this is something that we support and we think will be a good thing. From a business perspective, the change and increase the reduction in the tax rates for small businesses. As far as tax specifically is concerned, we think that we welcome this. I think there are a few non-tax issues and red tape issues and stuff like that that need to be addressed to encourage small businesses a little better. But the tax rates certainly are welcome. The special economic zone, again, to increase growth and to increase investment, we support that as well. Even though this is under aspects welcome, then I want to clarify this next point on certainty on interest deduction restrictions. We don't necessarily support the restriction for interest deductions, but I must say the one thing that is welcome, given the current, the fact that over the past 4 or 5 years we've had so much uncertainty, the biggest point here that I want to support is certainty, the fact that it seems to be something that seems to be written down that says this is the direction that Treasury is going into. That is the thing that we support. The concept of interest deduction restrictions, we'll fight about that at another time. The incentive to bring foreign subsidiaries back home to SA, where you have foreign treasury companies, belong to South African groups, but outside South Africa, to bring them back home and have them based in South Africa. The intervention there is something that we support as well. And then on the administration side, besides the specifics, and I'm talking about hopefully attending to things like VAT registration and ease of filing, and also the fact that we're going to have a kind of more web-based automated tax clearance certificate process. Besides mentioning those specifics and a couple of others, I think one thing that is significant to us is that the concept of tax administration and the problems that individual taxpayers are facing on the ground, I mean, I think we're grateful that that has reached the level of being included in budget proposals. I don't think we're there yet. There's a couple of we think this is one of my points, this should have been given greater priority. This is one of the things that is affecting business, just the red tape and the administration and the compliance. I'm glad it's on the list. I think it should have been higher on the list, but we welcome the fact that it is on the list. As far as concerns are concerned, I already made the point several times about prioritization. We remain concerned about the small taxpayers. When we look at individuals, we find that 10% of taxpayers will contribute to 60% of the tax take. Again, and people start, we have obviously the concept of being inequity in our society, and that is something that's a reality, but we do also need to focus on And as many our commentators would have said, if we have more taxpayers in the system, then we will have more equitable distribution. The point about retirement funds and contributions to retirement funds is something that I listed as a positive earlier on, and the negative over here is the fact that the proposal is to cap it, and there's many reasons why we oppose this. And, for example, it goes contrary to the idea of saving when you say we will permit you a deduction for contributions to retirement funds only up to a certain limit, and there are several other reasons. I won't. Because of time, I won't go into all of the detail, but in our detailed submissions, there's a detailed discussion on why we oppose this. The conduit principle for trust, I must say, this is the reason we are concerned about this is more around the question why. It's not clear what the abuse is. It's not clear that it's going to generate a huge amount of revenue. And it seems like almost, you know, it actually puts income earned through trusts on a different footing compared to income that's earned directly or through companies. So as the specific, and perhaps I'm going to interrupt myself and just say what this means. And the current law, income that you earn through a trust retains its nature. So if it's dividends in and it comes out of the trust, it retains its nature. This is the principle that's being now opposed, or the proposal from National Treasury is that that rule will now be changed. The income will change its nature. So. I think the reason I have prioritization on the slide is we're asking the question, why are we messing with something like this? Which, you know, we can argue about it. I'm not sure it creates that much revenue, but there are so many bigger fish to fry. It's not clear why we're dealing with that. And similarly, the same point would be with home tax on service fees, and this one even more so. So what this is about, this is if I buy services, if I get someone, if I'm paying a consultant or a company from abroad, and I'm buying services from them, when I pay them, instead of paying the full amount, I'll be withholding tax from them and paying that over to SARS. And the same point here, I think conceptually, I don't have so much of a problem with it, but I really have to ask the question, why are we doing this when it's going to add to compliance and administration, and it really is not going to bring in a whole lot of revenue? This is not the kind of thing that is going to raise the revenue for South Africa significantly, but it's going to raise the work. So, I mean, from a cost-benefit perspective, we question the prioritization of that. And then the final point here is, again, on the carbon tax. Even though there are some specific points that we make about the introduction of the carbon tax and the detail that we're hoping to see and the question of whether the tax will be specifically dedicated to emission reductions expenditure, we remain of the view that the debate around whether carbon tax will actually change emissions behavior. We haven't seen that debate actually run its course. The debate was open, and then out of the blue, in our opinion, carbon tax was just brought, you know, as a freight company, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, and we were still waiting for the completion and the debate on whether carbon tax is even appropriate to reduce emissions behavior in South Africa. So, okay. That was the last time specific point. Next slide, which is my last slide here, is actually a repeat, which is easy for me to do. This is a copy-paste exactly from the same slide that we had last that I presented to this committee. And we again, PwC, we want to express our concern about the legislation drafting units in National Treasury. We are very concerned that they are under huge amounts of pressure, and as a result of the resource constraints here, we are not getting to what we need to get to. Many of us, we've been, I'm not shocked and surprised, or maybe not a surprise when you would have seen in the Business Day this morning that Keith Engel has resigned. And I mean, this adds, it was in Business Day this morning, Keith Engel. Yeah. So that is significant. I mean, I think the article says that it's going to stay on until June anyway. But the point is, and if I can just go back to some of the things, just by way of illustration. I'm going back to my slides. The three bullet points here on this thing, retirement contribution, tax preferred, savings and investments, incentive for youth employment, all three of those bullet points were there last year. Do you know what was done about it last year? Nothing. They didn't have time. If I look at this one, special economic zones, that exact same wording was on my slide last year, and we welcomed it then as well. What did Treasury do about actual implementation? Nothing. Not because they didn't want, because they don't have the resources to get to everything. So there's a lot of cool ideas out there. And we have to ask So we have made the point that we have limited resources. That's why my point was about prioritization. And the prioritization debate becomes even more acute when we don't address the issue of resourcing at National Treasury. And perhaps I want to end off with the last point. This is something that's been a call that's been made by tax practitioners and taxpayers for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years now. Perhaps we need a period of 2 or 3 years where there are no major changes to our tax law, where we have a chance to regroup, to catch our breath, and really look at the consolidation and really take the foot off the accelerator for it, because the gap between people who know, and this goes to the heart of tax morality and tax compliance and things like that, half of the bad tax practices, well, I'm saying half, but statistically I don't know, but half of the kind of bad tax practices that we have in the country is out of pure ignorance. You have, again, you know, you have tax geeks like me sitting over here, and I can, but I mean, you know, chapter and verse on what's happening in some areas of the tax, but the majority of us in taxpayers in this country don't have a clue about what's happening in the tax law because it's become so complex and we haven't had a chance to catch our breath. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Professor. You will keep your students alive in your classroom the way you are presenting. Thank you very much. That will come to the questions. Honourable members, just note that. Manufacturing circle. Mr. Kundra, side note. Thank you. Executive Director of the Manufacturing Circle. You've also got 20 minutes.
Right, good morning, honourable chairs, honourable members. Thank you for the opportunity. I hope to be quicker than the 2 minutes that have been allocated. We've submitted a written submission that are quite general. It speaks to a number of aspects, although the presentation that I prepared for this morning aims not to be technical, aims to be quite focused in respect of three broader issues, the one being the current situation in manufacturing, to make yourself aware of what the situation is. The second being our view on macroeconomic policy, and the third being, generally speaking, administered prices and the fact that we think that in particular needs to be front and center in terms of debate around how we spend our money. I think there may be some distortions on these first three slides in your print back as well, it seems, as on this presentation. I'm not quite sure why that's there. But basically all these first three slides mean to illustrate is the significant multiplier effect of manufacturing. We did a study a couple of years ago at the Manufacturing Circle, which is done by Pan-African Investment and Research Services. It is headed by Dr. Raja Pedian, whom you'll all be familiar with. And basically all it demonstrates is that manufacturing, mining, agriculture are the most significant multipliers, generally speaking. They're always in the top three, more or less. Well, manufacturing and agriculture in particular. With respect to the value output, with respect to employment, with respect to exports, and with respect to the amount of money that accrues back to revenue. Therefore, it very clearly is quite an important sector to the economy. There's two trajectories that have been outlined in terms of what the contribution could be if manufacturing grew at 3.4% over a 10-year period, and if it grew at 10% over a 10-year period, and the contributions are significant, including on the 10% trajectory, almost 500,000 jobs. And clearly, that is very important because, as you'll see from this slide, in comparison with any other number of the emerging markets with whom we compete, of the same sort of developmental states we can be compared with, South Africa has got the highest youth and adult employment ratios amongst them. And manufacturing is the kind of sector that can provide the type of jobs that we need. So we think that if the Minister of Finance is quite fond of saying that we need to create jobs for the labor force that we have, not for the labor force that we wish we had. And so, you know, I think in that regard, manufacturing clearly has a much greater advantage over a sector such as a financial sector or services, etc. Right, just with regard to what's happening in manufacturing at the moment, this graph represents what's been happening in the housing sector. You'll see that the growth in mortgages to households have dropped significantly, which indicates that the people aren't building anymore. They're also not buying houses as they used to anymore. They're not upgrading as they used to, which obviously has a significant effect on demand for manufactured goods. The same with the construction sector. You'll see that the growth and profitability of construction businesses have dropped significantly. That's not only because of the penalties that they have incurred over time, but also because of tendering competition has escalated quite rapidly because there's simply less business. It also has upstream effects for manufacturing because many of these construction companies do own structural steel factories who now lack the access to capital to invest in competitiveness, which places them at a significant disadvantage vis-a-vis European competitors who, in the meantime, developed significant technological advantages, which are costly to invest in, and which our competitiveness incentives don't always support to the extent that it could, because it will mean that in the interim you'll take hands off the production line to save your business. Secondly, it also means because many of these structural steel companies are already undermined by the fact that the Middle Eastern competitors get pipe gas at a tenth of the price that that our factories get it for in South Africa. So people often equate what's happening in the motor industry to the health of the manufacturing sector. Here on this graph you'll see, represented by the green line, vehicle sales, which you'll see as relative to the performance of mining production, which is represented by the red line, and manufacturing production, which is represented by the blue line, performed much better, which is an indication of, obviously a number of things. Obviously, the availability of unsecured credit, relatively speaking, lower interest rates, but also the significant way in which government, labor, and business have been able to come together in the motor industry and the support that it has been able to provide to them. And we obviously would like to see that replicated in the rest of the manufacturing categories as well. On this slide, you'll see over 40 years represented growth in manufacturing output. There's a trend line that basically shows you what's happened to trend line. And then there's some indicators that kind of tries to explain what has happened and how those developments can be understood. The first 20 years or so obviously being heavily impacted by our seclusion from the rest of the world markets due to apartheid policies. The second 7 years or so we see significant, or actually the second 14 years or so, second section, we see significant expansion due to democracy. There's increase in demand, market expanded, markets for export goods opened up to us. And then since 2005, there's been a significant contraction again due to infrastructure bottlenecks, what we see as unfavorable macroeconomic policies, and obviously the global financial crisis which also followed. And over those 40 years or so, we see that since its zenith in the early 80s, manufacturing has declined significantly. That was also the early 80s is also when the mining sector was at strongest, which also goes to further emphasize the interplay between mining and manufacturing, and why mining and the health of the mining sector and its output is so important to our economy. So from contributing more than 21% trade deficit also did occur, and there will be some legislation that will indicate that. We see also very importantly that since 1995, there's been a significant decoupling between employment and economic activity. This is an ACORP slide, so of course for their very importance, the Labor Relations Act, which they indicate there was introduced around about the same time decoupling accelerated. But then of course that was also around about the time that we introduced our current monetary policy regime, so shortly after that, which we believe also had a significant effect on that trajectory. We have seen since the beginning of last year very concerning this unsustainable path that are now import and export decoupling. And there is another representation of it. We see it's because of per export performance, but also significantly because of imports that are quite rapidly rising. This is not because we are unable to manufacture the goods that we buy in South Africa. This is because of a number of issues, some of them being related to exports that are unfairly incentivized, that enjoy incentives that are opaque, that are much greater than the incentives that we enjoy in South Africa, and that we do not have tariff and non-tariff barriers at the borders that compensate adequately for these unfair incentives that are enjoyed by some of our overseas competitors. It is also because of a declining competitiveness domestically, where as the situation I mentioned a short while ago with respect to structural steel, where because of unintended consequences of domestic policies, we undermine our own ability to have our manufacturing sector compete with other manufacturing countries. There again, the trade balance, the deficit in pension throughout 2012, reaching a record high of over 20 billion in October. I believe the January stats are again quite bad. I just haven't been able to access them yet. Also a further slide to help explain why we see these developments. You'll see that they are represented, some of our established trade partners and in some of our emerging ones, the BRICS economies and so on. And you'll see that Germany, which has been a trade partner of ours for very many years, that imports from them have also been increasing. That's a solid dark green line that you see at the top. Have also been increasing, but we know that with Germany we have a reciprocal relationship where we import a lot of goods, but there are significant German companies who have invested in large manufacturing in concerns in South Africa and activities here that also export from South Africa. So that is a relationship that is reciprocal to a lot of world to a great extent. As we know, as has been emphasized by Minister of Finance, Minister of Trade and Industry, we don't have the same relationship with China, for instance, because we export a lot of raw materials to China. We import those raw materials processed into manufactured goods back into South Africa. And those imports from China, the dotted red line, have rocketed way past even what the Germany has done, and we expect that the incline will sharpen as soon as the stats for 2012 is added to this graph. These are Chinese, this is a graph based on Chinese customs stats, so we believe may be significantly understated, and this is because there are a number of traders in China who adopt quite predatory trade posture. They engage in activities and this has been noted across a number of economies where under invoicing happens quite often and where products are sent through under either the incorrect tariff codes or the values do not reflect correctly in some other way. And we can see that there on a monthly basis the imports have rocketed from I think it's just above 70 million in 1999 China from our manufacturing sector, our employment figures having dropped from around 2 million in the beginning of 2008 to around about 1.7 million. We've lost 300,000 jobs in the manufacturing sector over the last 5 years. That's 20 times the amount of jobs, more than 20 times the amount of jobs that Amplus recently wanted to get rid of, and have received quite a bit of political attention. So we see that that there are some other areas that should perhaps benefit from the same type of political attention. And obviously the result is that that the sentiment in the manufacturing sector has not been great lately, having reached a 3-month average PMI that has been the lowest in 3 years. Towards the end of last year, which obviously also coincided with the significant disruptions that we saw because of industrial unrest and so on. Right. With regards to monetary policy, I would just quickly like to outline our overall response to what's been mentioned in the budget. In the first instance, we support the countercyclical approach that has been adopted by Treasury over the last decade or so. We believe that works to strengthen us in times of trouble, such as we've had since 2008. But of course, it's concerning that our growth has declined significantly and that the outlooks don't seem to be met once the results are realized in time. And that obviously, the lower revenue that results from that will decrease our ability to maintain this posture further into the future. Secondly, it's always been heartening to us that, you know, even though change has been slow, that there was a significant mention of the need to prioritize spending on the productive side of the economy in any of a number of the last budget and NBBA speeches by the Minister of Finance. We were disappointed that it didn't receive the same emphasis in the last budget statement. Then I think, you know, if you have a look at what happened basically since the beginning of the year in terms of market reaction to what's happening in the South African economy, and then again since the budget, both with respect to what's happening to the Rand as well as with respect to, you know, certain statements that have been made by economists and analysts, there are significant drags on investment sentiments still that creates uncertainty. The one being low demand and traditional export markets, but coupled to that also concerns about South Africa's need to say dwindling, not dwindling, manufacturing competitiveness. There was a significant statement recently made by a top German diplomat which basically said that South Africa's exported or not underperforming because of a lack of demand in Germany, but because of our declining competitiveness domestically. So obviously we at the manufacturing circle received significant queries on the back of this statement. I went to go and check the figures. Indeed, I think the German diplomat somewhat presented a somewhat more rosy picture, but indeed their import stats there are climbing slowly, and our exports to Germany are still declining. And the reasons that I mentioned for this are quite valid. Electricity, for instance, our productivity versus labor, the remuneration that labor enjoys, and so on. Then I think that what's also significant is that consensus around the direction going forward, ironically, is becoming ever more fractured in the business community, amongst labor, and then, of course, in government, there's been a standing complaint that there is a lack of policy coherence and coordination, and then also between those different constituencies. And this was again unfortunately emphasized to us by the somewhat or the lack of mention of the NDP and the detail that should have accompanied it in the State of the Nation address, both in that and the budget. We would have liked to see more of that we would have liked to feel that the NDP is going to have a more immediate impact, but unfortunately it seems that is not yet to happen. And then of course it's also many of the savings, spending moderation, deficit reduction goals in the budget and debt have to increase significantly, or that certain saving targets would be achieved, or that there would be significant reductions in money lost due to fruitless expenditure and so on. Significantly, we don't believe that a tax review in isolation is going to really support the economy. That the truth, there's a number of economists that actually felt that it was quite weird that review were mentioned in isolation. But we have in subsequent reports on the minister's post-budget engagement noted that there is to be a spending review as well, which we think is very important to address administer prices, that whole issue, and turnaround of the financial position of local authorities, which has a severe impact on the ability of small manufacturers in particular to compete. And we believe that this should unquestionably trigger a monetary policy review as well to better support the productive sectors of the economy, as was once again emphasized by the OECD report that was released on Monday. I'm going to skip these slides, which basically illustrates the need for monetary policy intervention, but that slide basically illustrates South Africa's currency volatility significantly exceeds the average currency volatility for competitive markets. Our reserves are not, but it should be to help protect the currency against instability. And we believe that although this may be costly, that's what you do when you want to put money down on the productive side of the economy. Cost pushes and rand strength, that side is quite self-explanatory. Electricity prices, this is for one particular manufacturing circle member, electricity prices rocketed 250% over a 10-year period. Currency actually strengthened by 23% in that time. That's averages since 2002, which basically, and then PDI increased by more than 80%, which means from those two corners, there are significant pressures exerted on manufacturing and the ability of manufacturers to flex. This year, we explain our monetary policy position in detail because there seems to be a misunderstanding of what we are basically saying. All we are saying is that inflation targeting does not need to be gotten rid of, but there should be other policy tools that should be considered to help keep the currency at more competitive rates, to help keep it more stable. The current consensus amongst manufacturers would say that they would prefer a currency between 8 rand 50 to 9.50 to the dollar, we believe that this is something that could be reviewed on a periodic basis because we do not exist in a vacuum. There are developments in our external environment, and that should also be taken account of. We believe the Reserve Bank is doing an excellent job within its current policy constraints. We have an open door there. We are meeting on the request of the Reserve Bank Governor again on the 24th of April. Administered prices, I've showed this slide to you in previous presentations. The red bars are what's been happening to administered prices in our fellow BRICS countries. The blue bar is what's been happening with electricity prices in South Africa between 2000 and 2010. That's quite self-explanatory. And this is basically why. We, towards the end of last year, or ESCOM come with a presentation of proposals for 60% over 5 years, which basically amounted to between 18 and 21% for manufacturers, I think. At the very same time, Dilma Rousseff announced that Brazil would be cutting electricity prices for industrial users by 28.9% from January of this year. And within that context, obviously, the donation is for utter relief. And even though the effective increases for manufacturing, which will be around 10 and 11%, would still be above inflation. In addition to that, obviously high municipal markets remain a challenge. These slides, you will know, they come from the electricity intensive user group, who went and measured what markups is by municipalities on, this is for demand charges, and this second slide is for energy charges, the two different rates that are applied. And those are self-explanatory. You can see the markups are significant. The reasons for that are also in the public domain. We know that the municipalities are struggling and that they are using electricity charges to try and make to be relatively obvious. Specific proposals in relation to electricity, we think that NERSA has really done a good job. We really do not think that Eskom does not understand what's happening in the economy. We think that Eskom has a particular type of policy environment that has to work in, and that it tries to do the best that it can in that policy environment. We think policy environment needs adjustment in the longer term. For us, especially to compete better with how our emerging market peers are performing in terms of electricity pricing. But we think in the interim it's very important that there be an industrial policy measure to help manufacturers offset these steep electricity price increases in the form of an incentive or in the form of or what form it might take. These things are subject to multilateral agreements as well. But we have spoken to Treasury and DTI on this. And the discussion has certainly not been, they haven't been unreceptive to the discussion. Border proposals to administer prices. We think that a fiscal review is very important to address the whole issue of administer prices. We think that, that it needs to be mentioned by name in every discussion where the budget is involved. There is clearly some decisions that were made in the past and we may have to pay for them now, but there are huge inefficiencies in how we deal with administered prices at present. And so we are putting ourselves in a position where we might have the infrastructure in a couple of years' time, but we, regardless of the prices that are being charged, we may be unable to pay for it because we simply won't be producing the revenue as a result of the way that we've undermined our competitiveness. There are studies that have been done on administered prices in 2011, again, under the Fruit Fund at NEDLAC, where recommendations have been made. That study is gathering dust probably somewhere in IDC chamber or safe. So, ladies and gentlemen, please haul up these studies and use your political muscle to address the situation. Just on incentives, there were some allocations again announced for the competitiveness enhancement program. That program is working very well with manufacturers and DTI has really been stepping up the way that these incentives are dispersed. There is some report back that you can survey on your own time on that slide. Just with regards to the jobs fund with the NTBPS, you'll remember that the service that it's been outsourced to Genesis Analytics to deal with. They approached us recently and Paul Dillingham to make a presentation. There is some overlaps with the other programs that need to be that needed to be clarified and so on, but we are quite confident that going forward there may be some submissions proposals coming through from manufacturing circle members in respect of that program. Cheers, thank you very much. I think that's my presentation.
You spent within your time frame. Thank you very much to Mr. Kimmler, President. All members, as the two presentations, questions, please be direct and specific with your question that you put to the presenters.
Thanks, Chair. Thank you to both presenters. To the first presenter, I have three questions. First one is on the special economic zones. I understand you haven't seen all of the detail, but what you have seen, which is, I think, the main items are 15% income tax rate, that the youth wage subsidy applied generally to, regardless of your age, and an accelerated depreciation of capital. Is that package internationally competitive, in your opinion, given the success of such zones around the world in driving investment, particularly in manufacturing? And then you welcome the further relaxation of exchange controls. What would be the cost of totally relaxing exchange controls at this point? I found that passage in the budget extraordinary, where it says the Reserve Bank approved X number of investments into Africa. It just makes you, I mean, why on earth is a Reserve Bank having to approve South African companies investing into Africa. I think we are trapped in a very antiquated mindset as far as exchange controls go, and I'd like the tax community's impression on what stands in the way of, or what would be the downside of totally scrapping our exchange control regime. The one thing that I don't think you touched on that I quite liked was the idea that we allow the rollover of donations to public benefit organizations beyond the 10% limit. I thought that's quite a powerful idea considering the work that charity do filling a gap that perhaps government isn't delivering in certain areas. I mean, is that incentive as powerful as I thought it might be? I'm interested that you didn't bring up. And then, Chair, the second presenter, the manufacturing circle, the one comment was made about the MIDP and how helpful it's been. The table that I always look at with some interest in the budget is on page, one of the tables is on page 179. It estimates the tax expenditure, so it's the cost of our tax deductions to the fiscus. And, I mean, I like, you know, tax deductions to drive investments and promote economic development as much as the next MP, but I did notice that on that table in 2010, the MIDP is estimated to cost the fiscus around 23 billion. Now, I understand that in that industry you need to provide incentives like that to even be in the game. And clearly, I think we have around 100,000 jobs in the motor manufacturers and associated components. So the cost per job is relatively significant, but I personally would support the spending. My problem is that your suggestion that we need to expand MIDP-like benefits to other sectors or other industries, I just think we're going to get to the point where these things become unaffordable. I'm not sure if there's too many other industries where you have to provide such aggressive incentives just to be in the game, and perhaps the MIDP is enough. Then I'm very glad that the Union of Metal Workers are here, because this question of the National Development Plan, clearly the manufacturing circle now has just said that they're firmly behind it. They would want to see more mention of the National Development Plan, more policies appearing in the budget. But I couldn't help but notice the Kisatu's response to the budget, where they said that they reject the fact that the NDP is a broadly accepted consensus. So my problem is, if you've got the manufacturing circle saying that they like the NDP and Kisatu saying that they don't, you clearly have a difference between management and the shop floor. How do you, did you see this, the quote, or rather the comment from Kisatu, and how does that translate in terms of agreement from factories in total? We'd like to see, as Parliament, management and workers agreeing on the broad goals of the country, but clearly from what I've seen from Kisatu, it appears that they don't. And then my last question on the inflation targeting, I hear your point about wanting to have a weaker rand but retain inflation targeting. The only way I think you could do that is by having a higher inflation target, because if you have to keep inflation between 3 and 6%, you're not going to be able to allow the rand to depreciate without risking inflation breaching the other limits. So is the implication of what you're asking for a more flexible target range? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm quite sure the question that I will ask, we'll come back to the committee in terms when we look at the legislation and specific proposals. To the professor with the regarding the principle of the trust, I find very strange that this proposal like this coming from Treasury, with an assumption that people who have trust would like to be tax avoiders, so to speak, and also avoid estate duty. I don't know where the assumption came from or what rationale of this premise, but if you look at also comments that we've received yesterday, we find some individuals who own trust who is extremely open to potential liability gains, which need this trust, and this is what we need to do. We need to build business and investor confidence, and once you erode the principle of trust, you will have a lot of people not engaging in business because the risk is simply too high. many people don't just earn a salary. Many people go out there are entrepreneurs and they engage in huge rookie business, and they create a lot of jobs. And sometimes they would just like to establish this trust to safeguard them in terms of total collapse or failure, in terms of the other assets. So it's a very valid legal tool. I can't support the assumption made by Treasury that trusts are simply established to avoid tax. Those trusts are tax compliant, and that's my question to the professor. Is it what do you find in terms of the tax compliance? In terms of trust, are they avoiding tax? Is it established to avoid tax? And is there something we don't know? Also, with regards to carbon tax, it's also a very difficult one, and I think that will also come back to us in terms of legislation. But certainly the cost of carbon tax for Eskom, for example, we are totally reliant on coal. We have 90% of our energy generated by coal. We have huge emissions. If Eskom has to pay that tax, carbon tax, it will eventually, of course, be factored into the Eskom revenue application to NERSA, and the consumer will have to pay for the tax eventually. It's a very difficult proposal, and I find it extremely strange to have a proposal from perhaps the country, one of the biggest emitters in the world, totally reliant on, and it might lead to huge bankruptcy in terms of costs for ordinary consumers and businesses. Thank you, Chair. I hope that will come back to us in legislation, if the Professor can give us some guidance with regard to that. And then just to the second presenter, a quick one on administered prices. We've been calling for a fiscal debate 3 years ago. I've made many statements with regard to this in terms of how we price electricity. But we've seen a huge improvement now lately, getting closer to inflation-related pricing. The 16% revised downwards to 8%. It's still above inflation, we accept that. It's still problematic, but we're moving in the right direction, and this is where the regulator comes in. And I believe we should change the NERA and the ERA Acts, where there are certain provisions that does not empower the regulator to fulfill its role completely. I think the regulator, in terms of the Act, we can do a lot of legislatures. We can change those Acts. We can strengthen the role of the regulator, and that's what needs to be done. Just with regard to your comments on Eskom, that of course is doing their best, as you said, to fund the new build program. I don't agree with that. I think the Eskom price formula has been completely inflated. There's two aspects to it. Perhaps you can just note this down. The one is the cost of replacement of assets. It was inflated from 100 billion to 767 billion. And the second was the return on assets. The return on assets, or the return on investment, is the return for government within the Eskom pricing formula. That was from 0.9, increased from 0.9% to 7.9%. About the 700% increase, and that's where the reduction came from after submissions that we've done to NERSA, where they acknowledge that the problem lies within the Eskom pricing formula. And I can't see that Eskom can make this type of application and then, you know, be in line with our national goals in terms of job creation and economic growth. It needs to be placed on record that there was a problem in the Eskom pricing formula, and I would believe it's an avenue, and I would like to have your views whether we should look at that, whether that was responsible or not. Thank you.
Well, members, there will be a debate next Thursday on the fiscal framework and revenue proposals, so you can elaborate there. We must look at our time. There's a plenary at 2 o'clock and a memorial service 1 o'clock for the late Comrade Nkisi. Honourable Steve Swart.
Thank you, Chairperson, and to Mr. Bussano, thank you thank you for the presentation. Obviously, we have a full understanding of the need to increase manufacturing, and I just want to touch on a couple of the issues that were raised. Mr. Harris raised the issue of inflation targeting. We know we've got a flexible inflation targeting regime, but I just wanted to touch on your linking with the monetary policy and your suggestion that the Reserve Bank should be mandated to adopt an explicit currency band, and we understand the need for that, for the challenges of a volatile currency. But how would that work practically? Are you suggesting that the Reserve Bank would then have to intervene in the markets like they've done in the past, which resulted in great cost to our foreign reserves to ensure that the currency stays within that band? I'm just a bit concerned about the practical outworkings of that, whilst I do understand the desirability of it, whether it can be
achieved, bear in mind what happened in the past when the Reserve Bank tried to intervene in the markets. And then just as far as your comments about the budget in general and fiscal policy and investor sentiment, you seem to indicate that there are positive tones, but that investors may encourage a wait-and-see approach. And then further, you've also indicated there's positive market sentiment. All in all, how would you just further elucidate on how you see domestic investors seeing the market? Will they then invest further and go away from the large amounts? How much is it, Nick? They're sitting on 700 billion that is can be invested, and then also your foreign investors. And then lastly, of great concern to us, and that has been mentioned, is the issue of the administered crisis. You also indicate that issue, electricity costs, reduce our competitiveness. Of concern to me is one band is the 8% figure around, but local government are charging for local industries 10%, 11%. How are you addressing that issue, and is there something we can do to address that? It seems to be a major problem. You briefly alluded to that with the local authorities' turnaround strategies, but it seems that one forgets that, in fact, the figures that are being charged to local industries are far higher than 8%. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Kurno.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just a question to the Prof. Yesterday, somebody mentioned that there's going to be, it appears that there will be a double dipping. So, for instance, if I, as an African, work in Zimbabwe for 183 days, I'll be then taxed, I think, in my country. But now they want to bring in that you are going to be taxed in both countries. So, and that is a concern. Obviously, you can claim back, but it means that you will then be taxed at the highest level, 40-40 at 80% of your disposable income. You can claim it back, but when you get it back is problematic. I just want to know whether you've picked that up. And then secondly, on just to add to Steve Swart, I'm concerned that the manufacturing circle is sort of indicating that obviously we don't want a volatile currency, but we've got it. I don't think there's anything else we can do about it. We should stick to inflation targeting. That's the only affordable tool I think we've got. My concern is, can you really think South African economy or the Reserve Bank can afford to enter a currency war? Are you really thinking we can afford it? Have you made the calculations?
Well, Chabalala.
Thank you, Sir President. Ross says, I want to do what? Honorable Kurano. Thank you for the presentation. I think I'm mostly covered. I wanted to ask around the issue of the currency, whether can we really afford at this stage probably to weaken our currency for export purposes. But of course, if you make it stronger, so I just wanted to find out what you thought around that, just to get around the issues of inflation targeting and so forth. Secondly, the issue on the manufacturing part, you know, I want to find out, are we having an ability to manufacture? Is the industry really growing to a point where we don't have to find ourselves going out and you know, buying, because we're talking about infrastructure builds. My question is that we don't have the capacity to produce materials that we need. So most of the time we would have to also look into the issue of exporting and so forth. So I'm just saying that, are we really growing that industry? Are we competing? Are we getting bigger as industry of manufacturing in South Africa? And do we have the skill space around it to match that? Last question on the issue of plastic bags. I just want to find out your thoughts. Are we having companies that are taking opportunity around that in South Africa, but also what's the thought around the increase on the VAT that Kijari is spoken about? Thank you.
Honorable Mashile.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think from PwC, I read the qualification that is inserted under the page where we've got questions. I read the qualification. Then my little interpretation, it says, no, I must not do anything about your presentation. I just really need a little bit of an explanation. Then the one, probably then I'll get the professional advice on this one so that I can use it. You're saying that this small refinement or gap closures on our tax policies, you're saying for now we should not do anything about them, and then we must worry about the big ones that will be bring big chunks of debt. Do you have a problem with refining and cleaning up what we have so that it functions properly? And the other issue is, I think you articulated on the tax practitioners that are sometimes misrepresenting or misdirecting or doing work that is showing to the fact that probably our tax administration amendments, they are actually frustrating them. They don't actually get on par with the amendments that we are bringing. Hence, they are not doing a good job. Now, the question that I just wanted to raise there is whether these tax practitioners, are they not belonging to a professional group which engage in something like continuing education? Is that the case, or are we having these tax practitioners that just operate outside, not belonging to anything, and actually doing things as if we are still in 1960s, and then not being brought up on the new amendment that we have? And then with the manufacturing sector, I have realized that you really concentrated much on electricity, and which is more or less expected. But then I'm not sure whether you don't have anything to say in relation to the fuel levy increases, the 22.5 cents that comes in, unless if maybe with manufacturing that there is no consumption of fuel in terms of raw material and deliveries of your product and all that. And then there is somewhere where you're talking about the decoupling of employment with economic activity. You're having economic activity going all the way up exponentially and employment actually dwindling. Then one just wanted to know, within the fiscal framework parameters, what is there that we can do to actually reverse that trend that you can propose? And do you think it is a consequence of one of our activities that we are doing in terms of tax policies? What is there that's happening there? And then I think over this week I've heard somebody raising the issue of the rand dollar for manufacturing, talking about it to be around 10 to 12 rand, then that being posed to that it will be a better situation for exports. And now, given the other unintended consequences for the rent to go that high, you are talking about an 850 to 950. Which one is do you think is more appropriate? And whether there will be other consequences, unintended consequences, if this goes as high as 12 rand. I think those are the few questions. Thanks, James.
Well, this one, right?
My mind is just a request, I mean, for Prof to shed some more light on this concept of catching our breath. What goes into that? Because one might have some opinion if it has to do with limiting the rate at which we are legislating. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Members. Just in terms of remarks that was made, Parliament monitors the spending of departments on a quarterly basis. You're welcome to come and attend these meetings. It's open meetings in terms of the APP. The detail of the national development plan you will find in the budget presentations of each department in the performance plan, and speaking to the specific budget of that department. So that will take place within the next couple of weeks regarding the detail in the NDP. I'm going to give each of you 5 minutes to respond. Yes.
Okay, thanks, Shay. I should warn you, you're going to have to shut me up because I'm not going to make it in finance, but I'll do my best. Okay, I'll handle some of the questions together. A lot of them are similar. Okay, but the questions on the little economic zones and how do they compare internationally and whether or not we think they'll be effective. I want to kind of join that question together with the issue, the other question we had on whether I have any opposition to disclosure of the small gaps and we spoke about the issue of withholding tax on services and a couple of other points. And I think my point here is and let me first start by saying when it comes to tax incentives, they're mixed and varied across the world, so there's no real kind norm, but certainly we're not out of kilter and it should work. My bigger problem though is that there are other many non-tax issues that are perhaps bigger barriers, so I think we need to focus more on removing obstacles before focusing so much, and I'm not saying I don't like incentives, I have incentives, but we need to be concerned about removing obstacles first before we try and do almost like patchwork and cover them up with good-looking incentives. And I want to use one example. There's a proposal, there's that proposal that the likes of Kindle and iTunes and Amazon and all of them are going to have to register here in South Africa as VAT vendors and charge VAT on all our downloads and things like that. I am very supportive of that proposal, but I have to ask the question, does anyone know how difficult it is in South Africa to actually register for VAT? I mean, it's a big deal, and it's been on the radar for half a decade already. And it's worse. It's nigh impossible if you're an SA resident. If you're a non-resident, like Kindle or iTunes, it becomes totally impossible. So my point is, I don't have a problem with closing the small gaps and all of that. My point is, we don't have the time for that now. We have to prioritize what the big deal issues are and what makes business easier. And I'll kind of answer that question. On the scrapping of exchange control, and I'll defer to my economist friends on this as well, but I do agree that now more than ever the question has got to be, why do we still need it? I think most of us know that it's kind of an overhang from a very old regime, and do we just have this kind of like historic, traditional, we can't let go of the past? In fact, it's been softened significantly, and many of the approvals that happen almost just as a matter of course, so we really don't need it. I would warn, though, that many commentators will point out that maybe 2004 and 2005, when all of us were jumping up and down on exchange control, was probably precisely the wrong time to crack exchange control, because one of the things that perhaps protected South Africa was that we didn't have this wild and rampant exposure to the international markets that would have happened, especially by the banks. By the time 2007, 2008, and 2009 rolled around, we would have been in far worse trouble than we are today. So I think that it did protect us, the regulation did protect us to a degree, but I think these days there's sufficient fear and uncertainty in the economy to say that people are sensible enough to really enter the free market. Then I agree the rollover of donations is, and I think I should mention that maybe there are one or two things that are probably missing from our presentations on things that we support. The contributions by general society to charities and generally public benefit organizations is a significant part of society. They do really good work, and I agree that it is quite powerful. I'll limit what I say about that. On the point about trust and whether there are huge tax avoids, I do think that I'm equally confused. I think we do need to recognize that South Africa, more than other jurisdictions, there has been a history of trust being used as tax avoidance mechanisms. The point about asset protection and looking after your future generations and all of those become far more important. And I think National Treasury and SARS have very effectively, over the past 15 years, reduced the viability of trusts as a serious tax avoidance mechanism. So there is a history, we can't deny that. But I think where we are today, I myself am confused as to why are we going down this route. On the question on carbon tax, again, I'll just echo what was said, and statistically keep in mind that the biggest taxpayer will be Eskom, more than we're going to have one taxpayer who's going to pay more carbon tax than all the other taxpayers that we combine. statistically they will contribute to 50% of the carbon tax collection. How does that change behavior? Even if they wanted to, they can't change behavior. So what's the point? I mean, so I'm saying, if we are honest about this is about revenue collection, then say so. The point about foreign employment income, I don't think there's too much of a concern. There won't be any double taxation, and I'll just use a quick example. If you're paying 35% tax in the UK, in South Africa you just pay extra 5. You'll get that 35% credit immediately. So even though you end up paying 40, you won't pay 35, the plus 40, and then have to fight to get your UK tax back. But again, the question for me again is about, this is not going to bring in a huge amount of revenue. All it's going to do is add to the frustration of SARS officials who have to administer these credit calculations, and add to the frustration of taxpayers who have to go through this. I don't know, maybe Treasury knows something about a whole, you know, truckload of South African residents living in Dubai where they pay no tax. Maybe that's what I don't know, maybe that's going to say, I don't know. I don't think so, but we'll see. I'm sure there was a question about the VAT, you know, the rate increase. I mean, there's been no proposal. But those are some of the noises going around, and we're going to have to look at the next 15 years for the rollout of the NHI, because that's probably where the funding of national health insurance might come from, but that's one of the options. I just got two or three more points here. On the question of the disclaimer of our slide, it's a standard disclaimer that you do, and it's just about we like to give advice to specific people based on specific facts. When I do general presentations here, it's not really appropriate for anyone to think that every specific bit of data can be used by them specifically. So that's really where that comes from. But on the question about the issue of catching our breath, and also the issue of taxpayers, tax practitioners being compliant and competent and all that, I do want to make the distinction between taxpayers, the people who actually have to pay tax, and tax practitioners. And certainly in South Africa, my experience is that tax practitioners know what they're doing, they're compliant, they're competent, and all of that. My question is, in the previous round of filing tax returns, the Commissioner Magashula had a school YouTube video where he was saying tax, pay tax, or filing tax return is easy, and it is not. My point is, I want it to be easy, and it should be easy for taxpayers. I love the fact that it's complicated, because it means the tax practitioners, like ourselves, actually make, you know, we have work. So the point about catching our breath, and so, which goes to the same point about compliance of tax practitioners, I don't want us to be confused. I'm talking about mistakes that taxpayers make, and the fact that they can't do these, they cannot do this themselves without paying a tax practitioner a lot of money. And I think we need to try and move away from that, because that's really where the rest of the world has made a mistake. And the point, and just to finish up on the point about catching our breath, I mean, we've had so many changes over the last decade that people, you know, changes that were made in 2005, 2006, people still don't understand. Last year we had the rewrite of rules about debts. We have constant changes to the rules on controlled foreign companies, reorganizations. So when I say catch our breath, I mean, let's just tweak the legislation slightly to fix anomalies and things that don't work slightly, instead of making big changes. We really had more than a decade of big changes every year, and I hope that kind of makes the point. Sorry, I know I've gone over 5 minutes. Thank you very much.
You're at 7.5. You get 7.5 on the
Mahdi. Well, I should get half an hour, Chair. But anyway.
One question which you can answer in 2 seconds around this carbon tax. Have you tried to balance what is actually espoused in terms of budget speech with carbon credits? Because it's not like if Eskom has to do this, or carbon tax has to come into effect, there are no other mechanisms through which they can be compensated in terms of innovation of technology, carbon farming. So I just wanted to get you.
So again, and again, I'll try to keep it 2 seconds, but I think that's precisely part of the debate that we don't think has actually run its course yet. The issue of carbon credits, cap and trade, and all of those things. What is being said in the budget and what was said in the budget last year already didn't really get into that debate, and that's my point.
Thank you, Chair. First off, with regards to the comments around the motor industry, the intended implication was not that every sector, every category of manufacturing should be afforded the same degree of incentives. In fact, if there was no necessity for any incentive, I think it would be the best thing in the world. But there are some interim obstacles that need to be overcome. in certain places and so on, and so you need to compensate for them. But I think what I really tried to say is that it's not the incentive that we need to emulate for every sector, but it is a common understanding between the different constituencies that make that sector work, that we need to work. And the government has played a leading role with regards to the motor industry. It's really pursued it hard, and we see the benefits of that. Obviously, also, if incentives are delivered, you need to make sure that you get the most bang for buck. With the APDB that replaced the MIDB, there are some significant questions for lower-tier suppliers, which are moving their operations offshore, and some of the cars that are going to be built next generation will only have something like 8% local content, which of course the jobs for manufacturing, putting those cars together are still here, but for some of the suppliers it will move away. The National Development Plan, I think they, Honourable Harris, what you refer to is really, as far as I'm concerned, the fruits that we are picking now of the weak institutional grounding of the National Planning Commission. We ignored some excellent lessons from Brazil and Malaysia at the time that the National Planning Commission's establishment was put through Parliament in 2009. And so I think there are many things that could have been there that would have forged agreement early on, and that would have forged the development of the National Development Plan without specific interests shining through as it does in certain respects. Because even though, I mean, it is probably the best or better than anything that we've ever had than before, but there may be aspects that you may agree with or not. But the point is, we need it set up in a way that we can have leadership from front on it, and agreement supporting it, and that we don't have now. But it is a complicated debate to have, and perhaps there will be another opportunity to have it. As far as all the questions around our monetary policy position, I'm not a macroeconomist, but we certainly take advice from macroeconomists. We know what the problem is, because at the coal face we can see what happens on a month-to-month basis with exports and so on, and how your position, how your ability to compensate for the inflation differentials between markets and so on are supported by a monetary policy position and so on. I know full well that we are a small and open economy, but I don't think that we are in a position in South Africa, given our growth and employment conundrum, to say, well, we've had this debate 10 years ago, there's no need to have a debate on this any further. We think that there needs to be a review on monetary policy. There are a range of policy tools that you can possibly use. I think we perceive inflation often in the incorrect way. At the moment, inflation in this country is driven by administered prices. It's not driven by other stuff. Fuel increases will have interim effects. You know, if the currency weakens, it has interim effects, but at the moment, inflation is driven by administered prices. So I think if you want to solve inflation or keep it within the prescribed rate, administered prices is where it must start and where it must end for now. And so more concerted effort is definitely needed in that regard. So I don't think that you necessarily will have to change the inflation target, but once you've dealt with fiscal policy and tax policy, then your review of your monetary policy should at least deliver something that dovetails with those other two policy sets. And that's what we're asking for. With regards to whether it's 10 or 11 or 12 or whatever rand to the dollar, I speak on behalf of the manufacturing circle. Their consensus seems to lie between 850 and 950 at the moment. But as I say, we don't exist in a vacuum in South Africa. And so we believe it will have to be priority reviewed if it is accepted that you can move in that way. There is consensus around this between economists locally and the OECD, but South Africa is an economy that's set up to favor the financial sector and the services industries at the moment. That's where the economic orthodoxy lies, and that's the view that's dominant in terms of what reached us through the financial media and so on. And that, I think, as MPs who rely on what goes on in the media, you should always just remember. Just as far as administered prices are concerned, I think there's a lot that this committee can do about it. I think what you might push hardest for is not the the debate that's going to happen next week, which happens every year in any event, but that there must be a dedicated review of how we divide our money up, how we pay for infrastructure, how we finance it, how we recoup as funds at the end of the day, how we divide money to the municipalities. The municipalities are trying all sorts of tricks to try and get revenue that they're not getting in other ways. We've got a supplier, a manufacturer in our membership that has had a factory in Springs for 60 or 70 years. They pay their electricity every month. They've got an electricity deposit down of 600,000 rand. Towards the end of last year, they all of a sudden out of the blue get this arbitrary request to up their electricity deposit by 4.2 million rand. Now, I can only surmise why they're doing that. I know a lot of factories are closed, in Springs in particular, because of electricity prices that have increased. There's an industry there that have gone down. 800 jobs, 1,000 jobs get lost at a time. Ekurhuleni is not getting the revenue it's supposed to because the factories are now gone. They all of a sudden put out these arbitrary requests. What are they going to do next year? And for how long are we going to deny that this problem is there? They've already, the municipalities have put a request out for a local tax on business. The problem is there, it must be discussed in detail. Unfortunately, this is not the opportunity. I think with regard to domestic investors, you know, that figure of the amount of money that's available to invest seems to grow every time. Yes, it's almost like the infrastructure allocation. But I think, you know, investors invest where there's demand to be satisfied at a reasonable profit. And so if that demand is there, they will invest. They invest in the weirdest places where there's the greatest obstacles, but if that demand is there, they can satisfy it at a fair profit, they will invest. And so that's the answer with regards to domestic investors. With regard to foreign investors, I think the reasons were outlined in the presentation. I'm happy to have further discussions on that. My contact details, I think, is in the presentation if you would like to have that. I think with regards to the fuel levy, I think our biggest problem with the fuel levy is that we don't know where the money goes. We know that some of it goes to municipalities. We know that some of it goes to the road accident fund. We know a lot of it lands up in the big pool of fiscus. And so this was like the carbon tax that the first presenter referred to. I think it would be much better to stomach 23% once-off increase if one actually knows why it's been done. But there was no attention paid to that in the budget. We were only told, in the budget speech, we were only told about the increase. I think, Chair, I've covered everything, I hope so.
So too, you covered everything. Thank you very much for Professor Malachi and Mr. Besaidner. On the 26th of March, you referred to where's the money going. On the 26th of March, there will be public hearings on the Division of Revenue. You are again welcome to attend that meeting, even make your presentations. There will be advertisements in the media. It falls under the Standing and Select Committee for Appropriations. Received the briefing on the Division of Revenue this morning. Honourable members, we're going to have a quick break. I want you back in the committee room at 20 past 11. So,
stretch your legs, take a cup of coffee, come back.